Welcome to our Wednesday Business Talks podcast. I am Dr. Shai Vivekanam, Director of the Bettany Center for Entrepreneurship here at Cranfield School of Management. We're live today from the School of Management on our Cranfield University campus in Bedfordshire. Joining us today are Glenn Collinson and Phil O'Donovan, who co-founded Cambridge Silicon Radio, also known as CSR, a multinational fabless semiconductor company that gave us Bluetooth. They will take us through their entrepreneurial journey and the challenges they faced whilst creating and growing their business into a multi-billion dollar company.
Well, thank you very much for having us. Can everybody hear me? The back. Good. Great. Well, it is always a privilege to be able to talk about the CSR story, because for Phil and I, it was our entire lives for the best part of 10 years. And to be able to relive some of the highs from that period, of course, it's always a wonderful privilege. So thank you, and I hope you enjoy the ride. Before I talk about CSR, I'll give you a little bit of background on me. As Shai said, the link to Cranfield was I did my MBA here. It was actually back in 1993, to answer Shai's question, so 25 years ago, gulp. And the first comment I would make in this speech is that I'd recommend everybody to take that path. I started life as an archetypal geek. I did physics at university, and then I went on and did an electronics degree. And then I worked for 10 years designing electronics circuits. So I got to the age of 33 and thought, do I want to do this for the rest of my life? And answered that, no. And the way of segueing out of the lab and into the real world, as I often say, is actually an MBA. It really was a turning point in my life. And it was the first step when I became operating in the commercial world. And as you'll hear, a lot then sprang from that moment. I joined, after the MBA, Cambridge Consultants, which is where I met Phil and James, who was the third founder of CSR. And what attracted me to this company was it was the first and probably it was actually the only company I've ever joined where there was sufficient confidence inside the business of their capability and their expertise to actually bother to give interviewees a real interview. So when I was interviewed at this place, it was what I would imagine a university PhD Viva exam would be. I don't have a PhD, so I don't know. But it was extremely rigorous, and that impressed me immediately. It was obvious from the way that they were challenging me that they knew their stuff. Okay? And so it turned out. I joined the company. I was fortunate enough to get the offer. And suddenly, when I joined the company, I felt out of my depth. This was an incredibly high-performing organization. What Cambridge Consultants did then, and still do, by the way, it still exists, it's a company in Cambridge, is that they do contract R&D. So they go to big companies throughout the world and they say, we'll do this bit of R&D for you. And of course, to make a business of that, you need to be extremely good. Most companies believe that they can do their own R&D better than anyone else. So to win in that business, you have to be genuinely good. And these people were. So it was in that environment that we conceived the idea of doing CSR. So within 2 years, we had put our heads together, Phil, James, and I, and we created CSR, Cambridge Silicon Radio. So it does what it says on the tin. I guess we coined that phrase well before a famous brand coined it. The Cambridge Silicon Radio bit got dropped as time went on, and we became known as CSR to the world. But there were three of us who came up with the idea, Phil, James, and I, and we quickly recruited inside the business six engineers, and it's really these nine people that were the heart and soul of our business that grew beyond that point. So just to highlight James here, who was the chief technical officer, Phil was the managing director, and I was the commercial person doing the sales and marketing. The other six guys on this photograph here from 98 were doing the engineering work and developing our product, which was Bluetooth. So Bluetooth was made in Cambridge, and that's no exaggeration. Okay? Bluetooth itself was actually invented outside. It was the term was coined by a chap in Intel, and he named it after a king in Denmark from the 10th century. And it was a smart bit of marketing from him because it was a catchy word. Whenever people started to hear about it, the immediate response was, "What's that about then?" And of course, that's one of the first things you need to do in a very crowded world. And it was also smart because it was a technology that was unifying two realms of the electronics world at the time, the worlds of cellular phones and the world of computers. Never the twain shall meet at the time. Those two industries existed and there was little communication between them, either metaphorically or literally. A phone would never communicate through a wire or through wireless with a computer. And Bluetooth was invented to solve that problem predominantly. It was a wireless technology that would allow your cellular phone to communicate with your PC and beyond that to other devices as well in your personal network. And Bluetooth, because Harald Bluetooth, the king in Denmark, was the king who unified the warring tribes at the time back in the 10th century. You can visit, by the way, southern Sweden and see the rune stones and read the history of Harald Bluetooth if you were so inclined to do so following this presentation. So we didn't invent Bluetooth, but we made it. We quickly built a company, and I mean quickly, you'll hear the story in detail, but within a few years, we were dominating the business of building Bluetooth, making Bluetooth. And the form of that, of course, is the chip. The BlueCore chip was our brand, and we designed it first and then set about selling it in every single part of the world. And within a few years, we were shipping hundreds of millions of those little black gizmos, and every one went into an end product that allowed it to communicate through the Bluetooth technology. Almost certainly, half of the people in this room will be using technology that was developed originally in the company Phil and I founded, because that was the success we had. We basically shipped roughly half the world's demand for this, and that business has continued to be developed now under a different name. It actually was acquired by Qualcomm in later years, but that business still exists in Cambridge, and they're still doing these chips and shipping them all over the world. So with that, I have another couple of slides. Just inside that black piece of plastic, which has the chip, this was our product. This was the thing that I conceived with Phil and James, which we then went to develop and which we sold. So it's a photograph of the actual circuitry inside the chip, the BlueCore chip. And why was this so exciting? Why do I still get excited when I look at that rather esoteric diagram? Well, the reason is this was the very first example in the world of a chip that was able to put together completely different functions. So specifically, it has the radio part. That's the part of a phone or another wireless device that communicates with the antenna. It's the high frequency difficult bit traditionally, together with the microprocessor, which runs the software. You know, there's huge amounts of software, of course, in every single device, including the wireless comms link itself. And then the last bit is the so-called baseband, which is the digital signal processing, or decoding, if you like, which decodes the signals that run over the air. Up until this point in 98, the whole world that we were in at that time, the electronics world, was attempting to solve that problem. How can we put these different technologies together for the first time into one silicon chip? So our company in Cambridge was the first to do that. We did it with Bluetooth. And following that now, the world has switched to this methodology. So I would argue, I think with some justification, not only did our company make Bluetooth, it also changed the electronics industry fundamentally. So with that introduction, I'll hand over to Phil, and he'll talk you through how we started our journey as nine people and built the company. Thanks. Phil.
Thank you, Glenn. Good evening, everybody. I'll talk a little about how we started, how we raised the funds, how we grew the company, But underlying this is a theme, if you like, is a model, at least in my mind anyway, about growing companies. And that is that it's simple rocket science. I mean, you've all heard of the term rocket science, which often conjures up a sort of complex image. But the thing about simple rocket science, and indeed getting a man on the moon, is that there are a number of steps, a big number of steps. Each step by itself is encapsulated, is well known, well understood. Get all of those steps right, and you actually get to put a person on the moon. So, as Glenna said, the three founding directors of CSR, we were at CCL, great design and development house. We wanted, though, to do our own thing. The great thing about designing products, we designed products for Ericsson, for Flymo, for Black & Decker, for all sorts of people. But the great thing about designing products is that when they're out in the high street, you can look at them. If you've got children, you can say, I designed that, or I designed a part of that. The thing about Cambridge Consultants, though, is that it's the company that designs the bits that go in other brand name products. So in a way, you never actually got to say, that's mine, but because your child would say, yes, but it hasn't got your name on it, or it hasn't got your company's name on it. So we said, and indeed, you know, there were a number of companies that we'd helped who went, did their own thing, created great success with their product. So we said, let's do it ourselves. So that's what we did. So as I say, it is simple rocket science, but each step is known and encapsulated, and you take those steps one at a time. So the founding Bluetooth SIG, there were nine members, Nokia, Ericsson, Glenn's mentioned Intel, and in fact, we were member number 10. We spotted, James in particular, and Glenn, spotted the fact that the lightweight radio technology that we were developing at CCL was very, very close to the Bluetooth standard that was coming out. So we said, okay, why don't we do Bluetooth? So we looked at that, and we did. We joined the SIG special interest group, and we became member number 10. There are, in fact, as of June, I think it was last year, there were over 32,000 members of that Bluetooth SIG, but we were member number 10. So, and we, as Glenna said, we were first with the technology. When we started in 98, 99, there were, we counted them up, and indeed Glenn did a competition slide, or a couple of slides, and there were 50 companies doing Bluetooth who said, we will do Bluetooth. They might have been doing just software, or doing antennas, aerials. We said we'd do the whole chip, and we did that. And by the time we came to float 2004, there were only a handful. There were three or four companies left out of those 50. All of the others had gone out of business or had been acquired by other companies. We were one of the few, and indeed we were the market leader. You see there that, where is it? Anyway, after 3 years, getting your chip designed into a product is called a design win. And after 3 years, we had 500 design wins. And actually, we had 10 times the number of our nearest competitor. And that was because we were focused, we started early, and of course, we had the best chip. And we actually won the Royal Academy of Engineering McRobert Gold Medal for that. Five of us in the company, Glenn and I, James, two others, got that medal. Actually, they're gold-plated bronze medals, I believe. The company actually had a gold medal, and that was a solid gold medal that we used to display in our cabinet of trophies as we went through the front door. Where it is now, I don't know. It's probably worth quite a bit. I'm sure Qualcomm is looking after it very carefully. Glenn ran the marketing sales in the early days, and Glenn came up with a phrase that you'll all recognize. You'll recognize because it's much used now in a number of contexts. But to my knowledge, maybe Glenn will correct me, but I don't remember it being used in any other way before. And what Glenn said is that we will democratise the use of radio. And now you'll hear people saying, we democratise the use of this or that. What they mean is they can do it low cost, which means that everybody can use it. And that was the great thing about our chip. It democratised the use of radio because it was usable. It was very low cost, so you could put it into, and this was actually quite scary at the time, but you could put it into things like mice, keyboards, headsets, and even running shoes. It took quite a time for it to get into running shoes, but it did actually eventually happen. And the other thing that Glenn said was that we would do this for $5, because knowing the way semiconductors work, you know, price reduces by a significant amount every year, and therefore you can reduce your price and still get your 50% gross margin. But what Glenn said, and I don't know whether it was the first time he said it, but he and I were at a seminar in, must have been hosted by Qualcomm, because we were in San Diego, and we were standing up here like this, and there was a big audience. It was a tiered audience, so they were up there as well. And I did my bit, and then Glenn did his bit, and he said, we will create the world's first single chip, a Bluetooth device, at $5. And somebody at the back there said, no, you won't, I don't believe it. And you rarely get heckling in conferences these days. I mean, you do more in the other countries, perhaps, than in the UK, but they said that. And I won't tell you which company that chap came from. It wasn't Qualcomm, it was a semiconductor company, because Qualcomm were hosting this meeting. And we got hold of that chap, and we had a chat with him. And what he meant was, he was from one of the large semiconductor companies, and what he meant was that they couldn't do it for $5, and they couldn't do it in the timescale that we could do it, because they were a large, soggy, slow-moving company. And that's the great thing about founding your own company, of course. You can actually do things very quickly, because you don't have the weight of bureaucracy. So that was an early example of being heckled at CSR. When we spun out of CSR, I don't think, CCL, sorry, I don't think we realized the statistics relating to startups. I mean, Shai and others probably tell you about those on your courses here, but of spin-outs, or rather startups, both, something like less than 1% actually become very big, very successful companies. In fact, it's a fair bit less than 1%. And those companies, of course, become household names. The Googles, the Facebooks, the Arms, perhaps the CSRs. You know, those are the stuff of legend. So we formulated a plan. We, to get our investment, applied to, sorry, I phoned up something like 14 venture capitalists out of the BVCA, the British Venture Capital Association handbook, and some local companies as well. But those statistics, what we hadn't realized at the time was that if you, I'm a business angel now, a member of the Cambridge Angel Group, if you pitch to angels, something like, well, the angels see hundreds of pitches a year. I see about 300. About three or four of those will actually get money from angels. With VCs, it's even more stark. VCs receive thousands of pitch decks from companies every year, and they invest in, again, a small percentage of them. So we spun out of Cambridge Consultants. We took the CCL culture with us. It was a great culture. And we actually, I don't know how we managed it, but we negotiated TUPE as well. Some of you know that, transfer of earnings and protection of employment. So a lot of the benefits that we had at CCL, we managed to take with us. And I guess we convinced the VCs enough so that they were, you know, when they funded us, they agreed to that. So I remember one of our VCs at the time saying that, yeah, we like what they're saying, and we pretty much believe their plans, but do we want to invest in a bunch of consultants? And I won't tell you which of those VCs it was. I think it was a rhetorical question, but subsequently, of course, we proved him wrong. But for those who are doing courses now and are thinking perhaps of going to a career later on in design and development, working for a design and development house like Cambridge Consultants, who sells time, development time for money, is a great place to be. There are a number of them around, the Technology Partnership, Generics and others. But the great thing about those companies is that you get to do development, you get to manage projects, you get to pitch to customers, you get to run spreadsheets to make sure that everything's running smoothly, and therefore it's great experience. But I said one of our VCs said, do I want to invest in a bunch of consultants? But actually the thing that made James Glenn and I moderately different perhaps to some of the people at CCL was that we'd all worked in industry before. James had worked for Schlumberger, Glenn for Texas Instruments, a semiconductor company, and I'd worked for ITT. For those who remember, not many of them, you may remember it now, ITT, actually when I joined in the early 80s, was actually the second largest company in the world. And that company decided that there was no future in telecommunications, believe it or not. And they got out of telecommunications and they sold their interests to Alcatel and to Nortel. But bottom line is we all had good experience in an industrial environment. So we put our pitch together. I phoned up a number of VCs, as I've said, and I actually have to mention one of them to you. You might have heard Bessemer Venture Partners, an American VC on the East Coast. They actually said, yeah, we quite like what you say. Move close to Heathrow and we might consider investing in you. We were up in Cambridge, of course. So that, I suppose, taught us a lesson. It was one of the first times that we realized that you had to have a good number of opportunities, that is, VCs are prepared to invest you, and in order to be able to pick the best ones. And the one that said, you've got to move to Heathrow, was not one we wanted to work with. But to actually give them their credit, if you check their website, Bessemer Venture Partners, they do actually have a part of their website which actually says, these are the anti-portfolio companies that they missed out on. Actually, we're not there, but they have a whole list of companies that approached them. They said no, and the companies then became big names. So to give them their credit, they did recognize that. So just to finish this section, we raised the first round with three VCs, Cambridge, Herman Hauser, if you've heard of him, Amadeus Capital Partners, 3i, and Gilda from Holland. Our second round was Intel Capital, where even, believe it or not, Intel's lawyers had lawyers, and actually dealing with them was therefore quite difficult. But actually, they were a good partner to have. You know, we got to look at some potential applications that otherwise we might not have done. We then had a corporate round, 10 companies, including Arm and others, and we wanted to get investment from those companies in order to be able to design our product into their products. There were people like Philips and Siemens there as well. And the last round was a $20 million round, the bank round, SCP in Scotland and Lloyds Development Capital. And actually, this follows the, I think it's the fourth rule of capitalism. If you've got money, everybody will want to give you money. If you've got no money, nobody will give you any money. And what our banks, who we were planning to float at this time, said, you've got money, you've got some money in the bank, but raise another $20 million, and then everybody will think you're rich and they'll give you more money. So that's what we did. So we raised a total of $85 million, and then we floated in 2004. And I've got a few quotes here. I'll just quote one. One I really like, talking about success. Our success took, with some of the work we were doing in CCL, you know, a couple of years, then we spun out. After that, our journey was relatively smooth. But Steve Jobs once said, if you really look closely, most overnight successes took a long time. So I'll stop there, and over to you, Glenn.
Okay, I'm going to talk now about customers and markets, selling, okay? So in a year or so's time, you're all going to be commercial directors, sales and marketing people in leaders in your own tech ventures. So I'm going to answer the question, how the hell do you sell to the world, which is your market, when you're 9 people? What on earth can you do to beat gigantic multinational companies who are all competing in what is now clearly a big market opportunity? Where do you start? Okay? So, before I move on any further, the first and most important thing is sales isn't responsibility of the sales department. Now, I was really lucky when we did our venture, because I was sales guy, but the truth was, from the first second, everybody was selling. Now, this was a product of the CCL culture, Cambridge Consultants culture. That was a culture where if you didn't sell your services as a good engineer, you didn't get paid. In the end, you were moved on. So that culture within CCL produced excellent engineers, but every single one of them knew how to position their expertise to the best of their ability so that clients would come in. And that culture we inherited, and that was the greatest single differentiator for our company from the very beginning when we were only 9 people. Everybody knew the importance of customers, and it wasn't just blah, blah, blah. Everyone put huge effort of their own personal time. Whenever there was a customer issue, they would work on it to solve it. So that's the first and most important lesson, probably. The next thing is you've got to have the passion. It can't just be words. You really do have to believe what you've got is the world's best. I certainly believe that in my case. You can't fake that, because that passion is actually very rare. Most people in the big competitors, at the end of the day, they're doing a job and they're representing someone else's passion, the founding father's passion of the company. And that's where your greatest advantage lies when you're one-on-one with the customer. You can be more innovative when you need to be in that moment, and you can convey an excitement and an enthusiasm that few others can do. And I used to joke, I would walk down the streets of Cambridge and I would say, look at those poor people over there. They've got no idea, look how ill-informed they are, that we can develop the world's first Bluetooth chip. Right, it sounds ridiculous today, right? But I did. I was completely obsessed by that single thing for this period in my life. And it was that that sustained me as you put in the 90-100-hour weeks that you need to do to and burn the shoe leather to move around the world to beat your competitors. So passion is absolutely vital. The third thing is, if you're a tech venture, the marketplace really is the world. Okay. So me and Phil laugh when we get together nowadays in the pub of all the noise that you hear today, for example, on Brexit, and how people talk about how difficult it is for us to be leaving a particular arrangement here in Europe. Let me tell you, we never, ever discussed Europe or the European Union when we were building our business. Our market was, from day one, the world. And we found that that marketplace was absolutely open. There was no question about it. If you have the right product and you're willing to burn the shoe leather and you can present it with passion, you'll get a hearing, and more than a hearing, you'll be seriously considered, even when you are only 9 people, anywhere in the world. That's the marvel of the modern world. International capitalism does work. I can vouch for it. So you need to think that way from the beginning. Don't get caught up in worrying about we're leaving one particular trading organization. It doesn't matter so much. As long as you've got the right product, you will succeed. Okay, so those are the three big preambles to my pitch. The next thing I want to say is a very smart tactical move that we made right from the beginning was to steal this company's byline, love all, serve all. So what we mean by that is no one is too small to serve. Now, bearing in mind, we were selling something that was very complicated. It certainly was a chip, but it has to be embedded into a big piece of electronics. It takes 6 months of hard design effort by the customer with lots of support to make that project a success. As Phil showed, we did that on 500 to 1,000 occasions with these design wins. Most companies, in fact, all companies, ration the time that they will give to customers in terms of the support that they will give for their engineering teams to support the customers on those design-ins. All of your competitors will do that. That's the way a big company is organized. That's a great advantage when you can't actually support that many anyway. You open your arms wide and say, actually, we will serve you all. And what we quickly learned, and here's the secret sauce, you only need to give the customer hope. If he's got hope, he will find a way, or she will find a way of succeeding. And with that simple expedient, and by organizing our limited number of engineers to never say no, I didn't actually steal the slogan. We didn't want to get sued by the Hard Rock Cafe. But I literally did get badges printed that said, yes, I can. And every person in the company wore that badge. No one would get turned away.
Obama stole.
So with that simple expedient, we were very quickly able to compete very seriously in many places and win. And there was our territory, just to ram home that point, the globe. We did put in plenty of air miles, Phil, didn't we?
We did.
And I spent over 3 years, I had more than 40 trips to Japan and about the same number to Taiwan, where a lot of the electronics design work was going on. I don't think my wife saw me very much during that period, but thankfully she was supportive and helped me get through that period. But it wasn't work. The passion sustained me. This wasn't a job anymore. This was my life, and I'm not exaggerating. There's nothing I wanted to do more than jump on that next plane and explain to the customer on the other side of the table in Taiwan how wonderful the technology was that we had in our hands. Okay, that was enough to get us through to the first wave of success, through the first year, the first 18 months. We built a company by this time of 100 people. We'd started to get revenues. Now we move on to the next battle. How do we start to sell into the really big places? Okay, the big companies inevitably will not trust a small company, even a 100-person company. They tend not to want to trust it, for good reasons. A lot of 100-person companies tend to go out of business after so long. So how do you solve that problem? Well, the answer is you partner. Now, partnership is a word I hate. The reason I hate it is it's probably the most overused word in business. People use the word partner when actually often they mean competitor. They often use the word partner when often they mean actually we just lost a battle and maybe we can still salvage something from the ruins by finding a company to work with, a partner. So beware, ladies and gentlemen, if you hear partner-centric presentations from the people who will be working for you in the near future. The only place where I think the word partner is justified is where you are explicitly in a situation where the customer would normally buy from you, has done an analysis and has found out that you actually have the best solution, but because you're too small and there's a risk that you may longer be in business in a few years, for no good reason, but that's the way the world is, then it does make sense to license that technology tactically to a competitor, who in this case you would say is a partner. Okay? So that's what we did. So we did it first here with Intel. We made a license to Intel in order that they would then buy it, which they did. And then the next slide is we licensed it in this situation as well. Now, that word, Nokia, is a word that maybe even time as water has flowed under the bridge so far in the last 10 years that people really don't understand what that word meant in the industry. But let me tell you, that company was more powerful in terms of its market share than Apple is today in the business we were in. Nokia was the absolute king of the hill. It was the preponderant and dominant market force in the business of manufacturing and selling cellular phones. So to sell there was the ultimate goal. That was the Mount Everest in the business that we were in. And we succeeded, I'm a small company, only 100 people at this point, in selling our technology there. And the way we achieved that was that we made a license, a tactical license, to their existing supplier, actually our competitor, and through that license they bought the technology first, and then when we developed the next generation ourselves without the license, there was a natural segue into using that. So partnership in this limited example has been proven to work and did work for us. Okay. I mentioned Intel. An interesting segue, an interesting aside at this point in 2000, just after we'd done the license, was that Phil and I were in a conference room late at night, as we tended to be at this time. I think it was 9 o'clock at night. I remember it well. It was in February, I think, of 2000, just after we signed an investment agreement with these people that you had negotiated. And the investment manager phoned us up. Phil, I and James were on the phone, and he rather quietly said, we'd like to buy your company. And Phil said, could you run that by us again, please? And he said, we'd like to buy your company. And without blinking an eye, Phil immediately said, well, what kind of price were you thinking of then? And just there on the phone, they came out with the figure, we'd go as high as $600 million. Now, at this point, bearing in mind, we're around 100 people. We've only just begun to sell our first chip, so zero revenue, really. This wonderful future ahead of us, we were convinced, but goodness, how could you say no to that offer? That would have transformed everybody's life, not only our own lives, but all those other 100 people too, because they were all shareholders through their option plans. So, to his credit, to my credit as well, almost instantaneously, we said, Phil, no, we're worth more than that. And we're able to say that because actually we believed it. And I'm glad to be able to say that in fact we were right, because that was only just the beginning of the value that we created in the company. So the reason I relate this anecdote is that you might find it amusing, but secondly, it does seriously demonstrate the passion that you really do need to succeed. You need to have to succeed. You do need to believe completely in your company. And if you receive offers that you feel are undervaluing you, it is right to say no. Intel didn't do us any favors, by the way. Within 6 months of that offer, which we rejected, this gentleman, who was working for Intel at the time, who's still in the industry, by the way, you will see him in the press if you follow the electronics business, dealt us a blow. He went out and made a press release basically trashing Bluetooth. I think he had other political reasons to do so. I'm not sure he was necessarily he wasn't doing it from a perspective of generally trying to analyze Bluetooth versus the competition. But nonetheless, his position and his authority within Intel was a serious blow. And suddenly there was panic amongst the investment community, amongst our board, who were predominantly investors alongside Phil, James and I. And there was a call at that point in 2001 to find a buyer and to find an exit. Again, to Phil's credit, we weathered the storm. We weathered it through continuing to build sales. And within 6 months, that had quietly fallen away, and we were on to the next wave of success. But we did go through significant turbulence. We were forced to lay off a significant number of people, and I remember that well. That's one of the hardest things you do in business, is actually having to sit next to someone and say, I'm sorry, but your job no longer exists. So we all had to do that, predominantly as a result for what this gentleman said, the follow-on effect from that. But as I say, our resilience sustained us through that moment. Right, the little tiny Apple there signifies how Apple were back then in 2002. They weren't taken seriously at all. Jobs had rejoined, I think, several years later, but it was around the time the iPod was announced. They're very recently before then, famously we know now, almost gone out of business. They were known as a highly innovative company that did excellent designs, but a commercial failure. That's how it was perceived. So no one really was that excited when there was an opportunity to sell into Apple. So when I got into onto the plane and flew out to Cupertino, no one really noticed, I don't think. I mean, it wasn't a big deal for the company. Everyone was focused on the other big deals. But we followed our principles, and we said, love all, serve all. We did what all the engineers wanted. Very demanding engineers within Apple. Probably the world's most demanding customer. They consumed huge resources from us. So we did that. It probably was the differentiator at that time. They designed us in to their product. It was a secret product. They never told us what it was. We never found out until it was actually announced several years later. So it was the iPhone, the original iPhone, that we were designed into at that time, very early on. So again, love all, serve all. I'm jumping around a little, but I just actually, before I gave this speech a couple of years back, wanted to capture the moment when Nokia said yes. I was sat in a meeting room. I knew I was expecting the call from the purchasing manager at Nokia. We'd been through several meetings with them. And they did, sir, very Finnish, we will give you the answer as to whether you're chosen or not. So these are the words I scribbled down in a kind of haze that morning on 18th of March when Nokia said, BlueCore 2 is preferred. A long cooperation is planned. We would like CSR technology to, leader in the future. We will need to do cost reduction in the future. We plan to bring your BlueCore solution into Nokia solutions. In other words, we have chosen your chip. The single most important phone call in the company's history and to that point in my life. From that moment, it was clear to everybody this company was going to be a billion-dollar valued company. By designing into Nokia, you open up hundreds of millions of chips. The revenue stream from that one customer alone within 3 years was $200 to $300 million from one customer. That's a gigantic contract. And in the nature of the business, you're told on the phone, and that's it. There's no signature, no paper changes hands. What actually happens from that moment of commitment is the Nokia engineers begin designing the chips in, and very shortly after that, it's very difficult for them to turn back because they've put their own project back several months, and you are in a position where you're an incumbent supplier for as long as the engineers continue to want to redesign the chips with you. So there's no contract in the electronics industry. The contract or the signifying win is people's notebooks like that. And here is an example of the most important one of mine. Okay, I'm going to summarize this section by just putting into numbers what I hope is a description of the great success that we were building by this point. Let me step back a few years from 2002. And this is the original business plan that Phil presented to those VCs he told you about back in 99. This is what we said we are going to do. Okay? Here's our sales growth over the following 3 or 4 years. So in dollars, we are calibrated in dollars in the electronics business. We will grow $100 million of revenue within 3 years, we said. And they quickly laughed behind their hands, as they do, and said, yeah, tell us another one. But this is what we actually achieved. Now, we didn't quite make that proud boast, but actually, it wasn't too shabby, was it? We grew actually to $60 million within 4 years, bearing in mind that was 9 people back in 99. But that was just the beginning, okay? This is what then happened after we won Nokia and Apple and the other big companies in the industry. So we grew a company that by 2007 had revenue in excess of $800 million, and then very shortly after that, $1 billion. So that's not pretty impressive by any standards, I would argue. And believe me, to be on that ride and that wave of success sustains you and justifies to anybody you like to speak to those 90 to 100-hour weeks you put in at the beginning. It was a blast. And that produced enormous value. Okay, the $500 million that Intel talked about suddenly became a distant memory. Here's the market capitalization of our company that those 9 people had founded We floated at the beginning of 2004, and in billions of dollars now, on the y-axis here, is the market capitalization. And you can see how it went up and up and up to a value of $3.5 billion of market cap by May 2006. So at that point, we were just outside the FTSE 100. We were the 103rd biggest company by value in the UK. Well, more than the UK, on the FTSE 100, which is an international index, really. So this illustrates that if you do some of the things, and you have a fair bit of luck too, I will be the first to admit, but also you need to plan, then on a global scale with a globally in-demand product, of which there are plenty of opportunity today in the world of high tech, it's not pie in the sky to be able to grow companies to this size very rapidly. It's unique, I think, that you can do that in technology, and therefore go for it, I think, is my message. Why not you? Okay, Phil, back to you.
So I did mention simple rocket science, so a larger number of steps, but here just a few steps, three. And the first step is market engagement and early revenue. So one thing that Glenn did, he did a number of things, but this was very important, is the one I quote whenever I talk about CSR and marketing and sales. We all talk about focus, but what Glenn did and his marketing people is actually be very specific about focus. So when he said market focus, what he meant was we choose five key segments. And those segments are the ones you might expect, like PCs, phones, modules, dongles, if you remember a dongle, thing with plug into a PC. We focus on five of those. We forget the others. And we focus on the top three by revenue customers in, or customers for us, but companies in each of those segments. So that gave us 15 companies to focus on. And our objective, with all of the meager resources we had at that time, was to get our chips designed into the products in each one of those customers. So what we did as well as that, of course, is we, and Glenn has mentioned it, we had a partner program. And our partner program was a group of companies, and we had a website called BluetoothDesigner.com, where those partner companies helped people design our chip into their products. So as those of you who have been involved with sales will know, if a customer comes to you and they're not one of the 15, maybe they're very large, maybe they're a multi-billion dollar company, but they're not the 15, you don't say, no, we're not going to deal with you. Somebody else will help you. What we did, and I think we managed to do it pretty much most of the time, was to very subtly refer them to our partners and to our Bluetooth designer website to get our chip designed into their products. So that focus, you know, you can talk about focus, but that's being specific. So when I coach companies that perhaps I want to invest in, I say you need focus, and this is one of the ways that you can do it. So we've talked about territories, and it certainly is true that 90% plus of the countries that we dealt with in the early days, and most of the days actually, were Chinese-speaking, were Japanese, were Korean. Those were the companies in those countries were the ones that designed consumer products, and that's why we engage with those. And it's interesting, sense of urgency. I remember particularly Taiwan. Chinese are, I think, particularly urgent in Taiwan. I don't know whether there are any Taiwanese here, but I remember that they were dead keen to get our products designed our chip designed in their products, and quite often, more than once, what they'd do when they'd designed it in, they would actually send their staff with suitcases to our offices to actually pick up chips and boards so that they could take them back and put them in their products. Now, at the same time, and I won't single out any companies or indeed any countries, while those guys in Taiwan and Korea, Japan, were designing the chip in, were producing boards, producing plastic to go around them, there were people who were saying, well, you know, and these were people in big companies who you'd heard of, would have heard of, with teams of engineers saying, well, we wonder whether this Bluetooth thing's going to take off. Can you give us an education? Can you teach us? Can you give us a course? And by the way, we want it for free. And do you think we had the resources to do that? No, we didn't. So we didn't do it. So you need to be very focused. And one of the key focuses is, you know, I see it time and time again. Companies start to think, and some of you have companies or are thinking of forming companies, some of you start to think that you're an important company. And maybe you talk to politicians and maybe they say, well, we've heard about you, you've been in the press. Why don't you come to Davos and talk to us at Davos? So as soon, and I can tell you there are something like, I'm a member of the Cambridge Angel Group, cambridgeangels.com, and there are about 40 of us. And as whenever we hear a company that comes to us said, oh, I'm going to Davos next week, we say, right, fine, show them the door. Because you can't do those things and remain focused. So you can't advise politicians, you can't go to Davos, and you can't do any political lobbying. And indeed, you can't change the structure of markets either. You know, a market's there, it's been there many years, you need to sell into it, don't try and change it. So that's the first step, if you like, thing that you need to do in a company is be focused, be very focused. So again, something that Glenn was very keen on, and indeed Herman. We took Herman as one of our first investors. Herman was great for mind share. You companies, I can't do the Austrian accent, but you companies need to be know about, you know, the companies that I, Herman, invest in. So mind share and buzz from the get-go is very important. Logo design, mention that. If some of you are designing your logo, I mean, actually Glenn and I did this on, I won't say kitchen table, it was the table around our coffee urn in the first premises that we sat in when we were still part of CCL, before we finally spun out. And we designed that logo. And you see that logo there, and actually, other than taking Cambridge Silicon Radio off the bottom, has actually been in place from 1999 to actually still now. And the thing is, it has to be recognizable, it has to be clear, but it has to, in our case, also be printable on little chip packages. So you can imagine if it was a very complicated Baroque logo, if you take that down to sort of 8mm by 8mm, you couldn't print it. So we considered that. And there is a chap, if you're designing your logo, I have to get this right, Paul Rand. Now, you've perhaps heard of Rand Paul. That's a politician in America. But Paul Rand is a guy who designs, is a graphic designer, but he is very strong on logos. And he has a Paul Rand test. And actually, we'd never heard of Paul Rand at the time. But if you pass our logo, pass the Paul Rand 7-step test, it passes very well. So, copyrights, names, company name. I mean, company name is very important. Defense, Kinetic, anybody? Starts with a Q. You think it'd start with a K. Now, finding that is actually, it's a big company, multi-billion company, quoted on the London Stock Exchange. You know, it's got a funny name. How do you spell the name? Actually, Cambridge Silicon Radio, we started Cambridge Silicon Radio, we realized how many ways people could misspell Cambridge, Silicon, and Radio. I think actually journalists, are there any journalists in the audience? I always ask that question. Did you put your hand up at the back? No journalists. The number of ways that journalists, probably they're better now, but in those days, could misspell silicon. It could be silicone, and it could be silicon. We only deal with silicon, of course. So what we did after the first year and a half is we bought CSR.com. It stood for Consolidated Systems Research. And a small consulting company in America had it, and they'd fallen out amongst themselves. They needed money to pay each other off. And I've been tracking that for a year or so, and we made an offer, $80,000, and we got it. I remember the first board meeting we had after that, where I had to stand up and say, by the way, guys, we spent $80,000 on a name for our... And they said, we've already got it. Anyway, they eventually did get to like it. But, of course, CSR... Consolidated Sugar Refineries in Australia. Sugar company. They phoned me up and said, you've got our name. I said, what do you mean got it? I said, we just bought it from Consolidated Systems Research. And they said, no, we've been around for 100 years. You know, we're due that name. And I said, you should have made the offer. So, and of course, the CSR, Corporate Social Responsibility, is just there to confuse us all. So exhibitions. Glenn and I went to exhibitions in the early days. I remember we went to, this teaches you actually about competition. Teaches you, we went to CES in Las Vegas in 2000, I think it was. And what we realized we had to do after the first night, you know, you go to an exhibition, you've got your stand, and then you come back the next day, is our competitors stole our products. Now, we think we know who it might have been. So on the next day, we actually went out, bought chains and padlocks, and padlocked our products to the stand so that people couldn't steal them. Now, that shows you how competitive things were in those days, and probably still are. And, you know, every country does it, but we got it done to ourselves. So I've got time to tell a little story, just a little one. Okay. For those, I've asked twice, I think, whether there are any journalists in the audience. And you always have to be very careful with journalists. You must always, of course, always tell the truth. Tell it very clearly. Have a story. Have some imagery so that when you talk to a journalist, they write it down. And then hopefully they will publish the story in the way that you told them. Well, do they? I don't know. I can remember one time when we were leading up to 2004, we were being courted by banks, and the banks were visiting us quite regularly. So I was in an office, and in fact a lady from the Financial Times was interviewing me, and we were having a good meeting, and it was coming up to 12 o'clock, and the bank was due to, I was due to meet the bank at, I won't say who it was, at 12 o'clock, and my secretary knocks on the door and says, I'll say Morgan Stanley's here. Morgan Stanley, we're you know, coming up for 12. And I said, well, look, they're a little early. Put them in the lobby. Give them a coffee. And when I finished here, and I didn't say this is the journalist from the Financial Times, I said, when I finished here, then I'll meet them. And finished the meeting with the lady from the Financial Times, and then had a good meeting with the bank. And about, I think it was about a week later, it wasn't sort of imminent, you know, it didn't happen the next day, but a week later, the story came out in the Financial Times, and it was about 3 column inches. It wasn't a big story, but you know, it mentioned some good things about CSR, and they were all accurate. But you know what the title was? The title of that story was CSR tells bankers to wait. Now, could you have made it up? I phoned the lady who I thought I'd built a reasonable rapport with, and she said, oh, she said, I'm very sorry. She said, you know, it was the editor. He said, we have to have a snappy title, and that was his suggestion. That was the snappy title. So creating mind share and buzz is very, very important. And the last step I've got, the three steps, is manage growth. So we developed, we needed to recruit a lot of people. We developed a process for recruiting. Believe it or not, we were signed up to 600 agencies, staff agencies, all around, particularly Europe, but around the world as well. And we recruited in our peak 160 engineers into Cambridge I think it was sort of like 2004, may have been five. 17 different nationalities, 16% of the people were from outside the UK, and we needed, of course, to manage visas and accommodation and all the rest of it. But we had the thing is, I say simple rocket science, we had a process for it. Each bit of the step we knew and understood, and we had something to cope with it. And in fact, it did help that our HR manager at the time, Ian Campbell, did actually come from recruitment industry, so he knew how to do this. And of course, one of the things that we needed to do was James Collier and his development team, you know, we couldn't inundate them with CVs and with requests to interview engineers. So a lot of filtering was done by me and Glenn and others and in the HR department before James and his people got to interview these engineers. It's interesting, I don't have time for that. We opened our first office in Japan about 2000. 2001, and that was very interesting. I realized as a founder and as a senior manager at CSR, what my role in life was. And if any of you have done business in Japan, it's very interesting, very intriguing, very engaging, very attractive, but it's quite different. And doing business is different. And they don't like to give bad news, quite rightly perhaps. So I realized that my role in life, on a number of occasions, when we had a big meeting with Sony or whoever, was in a Japanese meeting, you line up on one side the people in your company with the people on the other side, your opposite numbers, if you like. So I was sitting opposite the most senior person from Sony in that meeting. And we did the preliminaries, and my colleague, the Japanese office manager, said, "Now apologize." I thought, God, what have I got to apologize? Have I done something wrong? Have I blown my nose or something? But apparently my job, and he didn't tell me before the meeting, my job was there to apologize that we were late in delivering our chips. Now, we were only a couple of weeks late, but the thing was, it wasn't enough for the local office manager to give an excuse. You know, the senior founder manager had to come from the UK to apologize in person, and I did. And it was fine then. Everything was okay. But I didn't realize that that's why I was there. So the bottom line, both Glenn and I have said it, is that by 2003, CSR, the little company, 9 people, was the Bluetooth market leader. And we had got 500 qualified design wins, which was 10 times more than our nearest competitor. And that was some 4 years after starting. And you'll see up there, where is it? Bottom left. We actually, in total, made 3 billion chips. Still, people think of us, CSR, when it comes to Bluetooth. So, that's our story. 17 years, from 1998 to acquisition by Qualcomm for $2.5 billion. And actually, show you how the market works. At the time they made that acquisition in 2015 of CSR, they were $130 billion market cap dollar company. They're now 90. So, things change. So, that's me.